not only has the Fed deployed a sledgehammer, they are all but guaranteeing that we'll be sliding into what could be a deep recession.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Like it or not, central bank policy remains a principal driver of asset prices in the financial markets today. This year, the Federal Reserve and many other central banks reversed years of easy monetary policy and began hiking interest rates and tightening their balance sheets. And one of the worst years ever for stocks and bonds ensued. As recently as last week, Fed Chair Jerome Powell answered comments for the public at the Brookings Institute and, given how they interpreted, or possibly misinterpreted what they heard, the markets roared higher in response. So, given its outsized influence, it's always wise to pay close attention to the dynamics at the Fed and assess what it's most likely to do next. To help us in that, we welcome noted Fed watcher Axel Merk, President and Chief Investment Officer of Merk Investments, to the program today. Axel, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you again.
Always a pleasure, Axel. Got a lot of questions for you about our favorite world central bank, the Federal Reserve. Before we get to them, let me just ask my usual jumping off question. What's your current assessment of the global markets, the global economy and financial markets?
Well, you already answered your own question, the jumping off question, which the reason I'm on the ground floor when we have these interviews is so I don't jump off anything because it is too scary to do other things. I mean, we'll go into this in more depth, but not only has the Fed deployed a sledgehammer, they are all but guaranteeing that we'll be sliding into what could be a deep recession. And this is going to unleash some very interesting dynamics. Whether they can do that is, of course, another question. But money supply is declining. PMI, the manufacturing indices, are declining. The economy is slowing down. At the same time, there is a shortage of labor. And Paul just said that, hey, we need to increase labor supply. So maybe you have immigration or whatever it may be. But those things take time. And so the only thing they can do is whack around the sledgehammer, and there's going to be some damage done along the way.
Okay, some damage done along the way. Okay, I want to dig more deeply into that as we go into the discussion here. Before we do, though, I mentioned in the intro Fed Chair Jerome Powell's public comments last week that he made at the Brookings Institute. What was notable about that talk? Clearly, the markets really like something they heard. There's some tempering maybe going on today, the day that you and I are speaking, Monday, December 5th here. The markets clearly reacted. Did Powell really say anything new, or is this an issue of the markets maybe hearing what they wanted to hear and maybe not what he actually said?
The latter. He said lots of things, somewhat new. I don't think there was a reason for the market to be all euphoric about it. Let me just jump into a few of the things that he said. He talked about a period of subpar growth. That's the higher for longer. Mm-hmm. He, as I mentioned already, he talked about the lack of labor supply. And he specifically talked about the pandemic having a net immigration deficit and deaths, about 1.5 million workers missing through that. Another thing he talked about more than once is asset prices being a channel for which to conduct policy. So not exactly suggesting that he is in favor of higher asset prices. And somehow the market took that as a positive. Now, part of it is that you got to go back a few steps. Remember the last FOMC meeting where he lowered the rate at which rates are going to go up, which is very dovish, but he then somehow did the impossible and convinced us that he's a hawk with this higher terminal rate. And the market took that seriously for about a day or two and has then taken that back. And I presume his speech was, because there was nothing new in it, we're back to normal, right? And the context here is, of course, right, the Fed needs to hike rates. And hiking rates means you want to break something. You want to tighten financial conditions, but you don't want to do too much of it. And so it's this cliff walk that he's going back and forth. And so the most recent discussion that he had was that, yep, I'm fine where we are right now. And so sure enough, the horse is off to the races and the market was jumping higher. Which of course means now he has to use a sledgehammer again to dampen enthusiasm.
Well, that's the point, right? Where so we also got a bunch of jobs data last week, right? That essentially said unemployment's still, you know, pretty darn low, and you know, the Fed has a dual mandate, and it's doing fine on the unemployment part, right? And Powell has said in the past, look, if I've got to sacrifice one for the other at this point, given how bad inflation is, I'm going to sacrifice jobs. And so the data he's looking at right now presumably says, yeah, there's no problem in the jobs market. Feel free to keep on hiking. Yeah. And then the market is basically easing financial conditions in a way the Fed would not like it to. Yeah. So the Fed has to your point.
That's right. Except I actually didn't think that job market report was so good. Some of the headline numbers seemed decent, but if you dig a little deeper, there were several areas of concern. The biggest one of relevance, including to the Fed, is probably that the labor participation rate is not moving in the right direction. And so we, quote unquote, want to be back at the pre-pandemic labor participation rate. But let's not forget how we got there. For years, the labor participation rate was declining, making lower highs. Part of it is the addiction rates in the US and the prime labor market. Part of it is early retirement because high asset prices and so forth. And then, of course, the pandemic hasn't helped. But the reason that there was a counter trend was really through the tax changes that happened and the cutting of red tape in the previous administration. And you may love or hate that previous president, but he really got that job market to shift to higher gear. And now, of course, we have red tape being the flavor of the day and not exactly providing incentives to go back to work. Now, of course, some of these, the obstacles to go back to work, like daycare being available, vaccines being available, those sort of things have come about, but that's not enough to go back to pre-pandemic levels. And so, and then of course you have you've got sufficient of a welfare system that if you don't want to be in the labor market, you don't necessarily have to be. And so people got a taste of what it is to be on the sideline. And so it's going to be very, very difficult to get that labor participation rate up. And in the meantime, not all the underlying data in the jobs report were so great. And let's not forget, right, those things do act with a lag. That's why I pointed out to the manufacturing numbers not being looking great. And then what's not in that report is, of course, money supply, right? Money supply is coming down. And that is an indicator that that this economy is indeed slowing, and it's slowing fast.
Okay. But so I agree with you. We could have a whole separate discussion on the outlook for the labor market, because I'm actually pretty darn bearish on it. And I think there's a lot in the jobs reports that we've been getting that is, you know, either suspect or excessively rosy. And of course, as you said, those are lagging indicators. But my guess is that at a high level, Powell is, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so correct me if this is wrong, but I think he's almost sort of welcoming that the unemployment rate is still so low in all of this. I don't get the sense he's staying up late worrying about the jobs market. I think he's saying, I'm glad it is where it is, because it gives me the optics to keep, you know, my foot to the pedal in terms of tightening and hiking.
Well, he said when he gets up, he starts working. Before work, he starts working. I do think it keeps him up at night. But you're absolutely right. It gives him political cover to have rates high. But at the same time, that's not good enough. Right, with the dislocations you have in the labor market, he must come to a place where they are more unemployed. And as you know, I at least used to be very active in the currency markets, less so than I used to be. And my experience had always been that when a currency moves quickly, when something happens quickly, politicians don't care. But when something happens slowly, gradually, everybody starts complaining. Oh my God, my currency is too high and this and that. And so similarly, if the unemployment rate goes up rather slowly, you have this opportunity for political backlash. So he may sleep better right now, but I don't know, and I don't think it's going to be good for him politically that this may actually be a long and grinding process. And of course, we don't know how long a process it will be. But the fact that, just think about in the pandemic, right? The unemployment rate just surged. And ever since then, everybody, at least the president is bragging how many jobs are being created, right? And so it's when something whacks you quickly, well, you don't have much time to complain about it. Whereas if it happens more slowly, I'm not so sure whether the Fed has fully appreciated the political dimensions of what it's embarking on.
Maybe, and I guess let me just stay on this topic for one last moment, which is, I feel like Powell has been saying for months now, almost that he's declaring war on jobs, right? That he's been saying, look, you know, we have this economy that's, you know, somewhat overheated, or at least it's resulted in this higher inflation. And I can't do too much about the supply side of things, but I can work on the demand side of the equation. And it's my job to bring demand down. And he's talked about the imbalance between the number of openings versus the number of workers applying for them. And it sounds like, you know, to me at least, that he's been is to kind of cool things off here. You know, I'm hiking and tightening. I'm trying to destroy demand. That is, to a certain extent, even though he might not connect these dots as clearly for everybody as I'm right now, but he's basically saying, and that means that, you know, we're going to have to compress margins and companies are going to have to lay off people a bit, you know, and you know, that's going to be the trade-off I'm going to make here. I'm going to trade jobs for lower inflation, less jobs for lower inflation. Yeah. You're kind of gritting your teeth as I'm saying this. So.
Well, the only reason is, if those of us who are old enough remember Greenspan, who was very willing to talk to the fiscal folks and tell them, you guys got to do this and that and get your act together. He just backed off a little bit about the specific policy, but he was quite enthusiastic about certain policies. Indeed, the Bernanke, when he wrote his book, ostracized Greenspan for it. And ever since Greenspan, there has been a very much a reluctance to comment on fiscal policy. And indeed, if anything, when Powell spoke last week, he was going down that rabbit hole. He said, you guys got to do something on the supply side. I mean, short of saying you got to give out 2 million immigrant visas to increase the labor supply, he was quite close to that, right? But then, yes, he, after saying you guys got to do something, he said, well, our tool is the sledgehammer, and that's what we're going to use. He didn't use exactly those words, but yes, he will use the tools that they have, which means induce a recession.
Okay, great. And we're going to get to that point right now. But I think this is a really important point just to surface for folks to clearly understand, which is Powell is saying, look, I'm doing what I can do. Right, I'm going to bring demand down to try to keep inflation under control. That is going to result in less jobs going forward. But we still have this jobs worker mismatch, and you know, we need workers to keep the economy going. And therefore, you guys, Congress, you've got to do some stuff to try to boost the labor supply here. Right, did I capture that correctly?
No.
Okay.
I had to take a note because I was afraid you'd go too far. You have drank the Kool-Aid like everybody else. Powell says, I can do what I can do. No, he could resign. He can do much more than he is doing. It is just unacceptable that the Fed has given us the Great Depression, Great Inflation 1, Great Inflation 2. Larry Summers, whom I'm not a fan on many topics, he said, in order to get out of inflation, we need a new framework. And what Powell said last week, he was asked about this idiotic backward inflation averaging thing. He said, oh, we're going to look at that at our next review in 2025, 2026, but we got to get through this. And that's just not acceptable, right? There is so much more that Powell could do other than just blame the model for not having caught it. He said, nobody predicted inflation is going to be high.
Yeah,
I would
yeah.
think that there are a few people that watch your program and have spoken on your program that right. might disagree with that.
Two right? of whom so are talking is, to each other there, right now.
There,
yeah.
There is so much more the Fed could do. And the thing is, right, to just take a step back, the year-over-year inflation numbers are going to look better in the coming months right. just because of the base effect. So, And that will probably, I believe in May, the Fed will stop, they pause. But that doesn't mean inflation will have been beaten, right? Once inflation is high, it's not linear anymore. It tends to be volatile because it starts popping up in different areas. And yes, using the sledgehammer, you can kill economic growth. You can do that. But there is a lot more the Fed could be doing. And one of them is not to just worry about the problem of the day, but publish where they're going to be as far as a reaction function. One of the less, let me stop using these not so flattering comments, but Powell wrongly said, hey, no, the markets are pricing in things much earlier than they used to. No, the Fed is giving forward guidance more than they used to, mm-hmm. right? And so, yes, information flow is faster, but the Fed is already, like Powell said, oh, forward guidance is dead, only to start giving forward guidance again, right? And that is why the market is pricing in more. Whereas if we had a reaction function, pardon my jargon here, but something that would be clearer what we'll have. And as you're aware, we work with Bill Poole, the former St. Louis Fed president. He used to be at the St. Louis Fed until 2008. And he said we should replace the discretionary authority of the Fed with the simple formula that goes based on the CPI and the unemployment rate. And one of the problems that the Fed has is it's a debating club. And that reaches consensus. Now, clearly the chair has more power than the other ones, but almost by definition, the Fed is going to be late. It's going to be late reacting to rising inflation. And of course, now with this higher for longer theme, they're boxing themselves in to being late on the other side of things. It's just an inappropriate way to conduct policy. It screams everybody in the face. And I disagree with this notion that Powell does everything that he can do. No, you have to change the system, if not break the system.
All right. So just going back to my point before, because you are talking, this is where I wanted to take the conversation anyway, so it's great. You were talking about what the Fed could or should do. I just was trying to clarify what we think the Fed is going to do, given what Powell is telling us, right? And so the way I see it is that Powell is saying, look, I am going to do this, right? I'm bringing demand down, probably going to destroy some jobs in a moment. And I do want to get to talk about how big we think this recession that the Fed may be causing here is going to be. And he's saying, look, to really try to right-size the labor force, Congress, I'm looking for you for help to do that by increasing supply of workers while I'm increasing demand for jobs. If that's the way that things are shaping up here right now, I do think it's interesting that now that we're past the midterm elections and we have a divided Congress, I don't think we can really expect Congress to work together to get much of anything done. So I wouldn't expect Congress to be very successful in rallying to what Powell is asking of it here.
So two answers. Let me just continue poking fun at what you say here.
Poke away.
They're working together. So I think you are way too intellectual about this. No offense. But Powell has made himself a hostage of what he has announced and the calendar. It doesn't, unless the wheels start falling off, in which they're going to take the fire hose off. And I actually thought that would be more likely to happen a few weeks and months ago than right now. We can talk about that separately. But right now, they're hostage of the calendar. They'll raise 50 basis points now, and then twice 25 basis points, and then they'll pause in May. And the reason I say that is because the Fed needs a few inflation numbers that are okay. Now, mm-hmm. next week, we'll have an inflation report, and maybe it's completely horrible, but it should start coming down. They might be higher than expected. And the Fed realizes that they've slammed on the brakes too hard, but they've boxed themselves in. And so they'll continue hiking rates, but just a little bit. And they'll say, all right, 25 basis points, it's going to be enough. Now, ultimately, the Federal Reserve is focusing on core PCE. It's one of these inflation metrics that's more akin to most of us. That one is published with about a 4-week delay. And so the February PCE report is not available until late March, which is too late for the March Fed meeting. And then the follow-up meeting is in early May. And that, to me, means they'll pause in early May. That's the earliest, really, that they can pause. And it's the only time that they can pause. And so when you start talking about all these wonderful things they're considering, yeah, I don't think it's that complicated. It's much simpler. Now, to the question you wanted to ask about the working together, you're absolutely right, of course, that's not going to happen. We're going to have gridlock in Congress, which is one of the best things you can have. But it also means a gridlock means less spending, right? Unless, of course, you put some package full with lots of goodies for everybody. That's another way you can pass things in Congress. But the odds of money supply not being supported by Congress is actually quite high. Mm-hmm. And so, and the one thing to just get back to that, right? Opening the floodgates of immigration, I don't think that's exactly going to happen either. And as much as you may or may not like immigration, that is indeed correct. Increasing the supply of labor would tame wage growth, right? And would help getting the economy into balance from that point of view, just from an economics point of view.
All right. So, Axel, you and I have talked for many, many years. I have been beating the drum a lot this year about my personal concerns for the potential scope of layoffs for next year. We've had such a nice run, you know, tranquil run since the 08 crisis. I think that there's a lot of people that have either forgotten or honestly haven't really lived through what a serious recession can look and feel like, right? But you and I obviously have been through several. And so I've just been trying to, you know, beat the drum to wake people up for the potential of, hey, if you work for a paycheck, you might need to be concerned about your job next year, depending upon how bad this recession gets. You seem from some of your comments here to be quite concerned about the depth of the recession that the Fed could be engineering for us here. So let's talk about that just for a moment here. So don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you are concerned about a material recession next year. And, you know, keeping the dot-com bust and the great financial crisis in mind, right now, where would your gut kind of put it in terms of the magnitude that you think it could be?
Yeah, so let me go one step further back. I think the recession where, or it wasn't even a big recession, where we had the most job cuts was probably in the early 90s in recent memory, where by the tens of thousands, job cuts were announced, and that was kind of an early wave of transitioning to a more digital economy, companies re-engineering themselves. And surprisingly, markets didn't do that poorly in that sort of environment. Indeed, whenever some layoffs were announced, share prices of that company were jumping higher. That's not the sort of environment I'm foreseeing right now, but that, if you talk about like massive layoffs, that was a period that had this grinding process where tens of thousands of people were announced to be laid off one week after the other and so forth. Now, in the current environment, of course, one reason why companies are a little bit reluctant to lay off people is because you currently, at least, still have that huge disconnect and they might not be able to hire them back. Right. And so that might kind of hide some of the weakness that we have in the labor market. The areas we have seen is where we've had some extreme overhiring. And I don't want to go into too many specific companies, but the big tech companies, they were just throwing out things, we need to hire. And what they have done basically is they said, all right, we've hired too many. If you don't live up to much more stringent requirements, you're going to be out. And then they expedited and kicked out a bunch of people and so forth. And of course, these tech companies invest in areas sometimes that that might not be exactly in the next profit center. In that sense, the tech sector has always been a leading indicator, right? It's company specific, and right. Then it starts broadening out. The consumer continues to be reasonably strong, and so that's also held people back. And in some ways, of course, because of the pandemic, most of the economic indicators we're looking at are all a bit messed up. And so they're jumping around and so forth. But yes, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket. My late father, he passed away in 2014. He used to manage his mother's portfolio. And very simple, just moving it from bonds to stocks when there were big changes in the economic cycle. And that's a fancy way of saying, don't fight the Fed, right? I mean, we can complain about the Fed all the time, but they're tightening the screws. And historically, when you have a deep recession, not so much for a shallow recession, but for deep recessions, equity markets, S&P type of equities, they bottom out about half to two-thirds through a recession. Now, based on what the US government looks at a recession, and you can say that's you don't like that metric, but if you do austere comparisons to how the S&P has performed, it's that government metric of a recession. We're not in a recession yet. Indeed, the components that the bureaucrats look at are all pointing still to growth. They're just starting to turn over. And so what that, of course, may mean, and that the whole, I mean, we talk about the Fed, maybe because we love talking about the Fed. No, we talk about the Fed because of the implications it has for our investments, right? And so based on that, we are not halfway through a recession. And based on that, we are not in the lows of the equity markets. Now, how deep a recession will be? Well, it depends when the Fed is going to get cold feet. But Milton Friedman used to say the Fed policy acts with a long and variable lag. And that's, in my view, absolutely true, right? And so it's unprecedented in history how much money supply is contracting right now. We continue to hike rates. If we were to follow a Taylor rule, we should be cutting rates right now. Now, we should be cutting rates, obviously, from a much, much higher level. And that's part of the mess that we are in. But it means that the Fed is going to do extensive damage, especially since they've boxed themselves in with the higher for longer, because the only credibility they have is that higher for longer slogan, right? And that's one of the reasons. I'm not just saying we should get rid of the discretionary power of the Fed because they've done something wrong, but because truly the entire kind of feedback loop that they have is not working. And that is why we're going to create so much more damage than is necessary. And even if we, if and when we do create that damage, it doesn't mean we'll have beaten inflation. We'll create right. a lot of damage.
Right. So, I mean, you and I, again, we've spent a lot of time on previous interviews talking about how, in many ways, you know, these are traps, these are corners that the Fed has put itself in by its own actions, right? It contributed to the blowing of all these, you know, asset price bubbles. We then had the pandemic, you know, shutdown, at which point the Fed just went hog wild in terms of monetary stimulus in conjunction with fiscal stimulus. We then had this massive inflation. Then the Fed eased way longer than it should have into that, right? So, and now it's at the point where you just described, you know, where its current actions are probably making things even worse. You know, to a certain
extent. And it's worse than that, right? It's not only did they create all these dislocations, but they have driven a generation of investors that were investing based on fundamentals out of the market.
Wow. Right? Because if you
did
Keep
any,
going.
Because if you did any reasonable analysis, you pretty much got yourself out of business. The rules were changing in 2008, and then the money printing. Well, guess what? The markets go higher and higher and higher. If you did anything but the index, you underperformed and lost your job. And so now we're at a stage where a lot of those veterans are no longer in the markets, and you have all these kiddies around that don't really know how to invest, right? And so we're learning, but that exacerbates, I think, the issues. And of course, then that's not the Fed's fault. You have Dodd-Frank has come in and lots of other things that create distortions that that create a liquidity that's skin deep, right? And so it looks like there's a lot of liquidity, but that can evaporate in a moment. And so we have this very toxic mix that's driving the markets these days.
All right, very toxic mix, very good way to put it. I have a direction I'm going with in this conversation, but just to emphasize this point for a moment, because I think it's a really important one, and I've tried to bang this drum a couple of times in previous interviews, is we have basically created an investing class now on the institutional side, largely of sort of momentum chasers, right? Which is what you said, right? All these deformations that the Fed and the other central planners have injected into the system have made the winning playbook the don't fight the Fed, just follow the liquidity, just chase yeah. momentum, you're going to be fine, buy the dip, right? Go long. And so we, the people that have any musculature on how to do real fundamental analysis and work in a, you know, freer and fairer market, well, those guys are retiring out of the system here at this point, right? At the same time, we have inflated asset prices to the point where the younger generation has said, my God, the American dream is, I'm getting priced out of it. And the only way where I'm going to have a hope of getting it is if I get, you know, lucky in buying the meme stock or the crypto asset, you know, that gets on a rocket ride, right? So we've encouraged speculation in the younger generation of investors. And my big fear is, as this house of cards comes down, as it highly likely inevitably will, a lot of money is going to be lost by the institutional momentum folks because they're using the wrong playbook for that type of market. But I think potentially you could discourage the younger generation as they get burned by their assets collapsing from really ever being investors ever again, right? It's the old, like, you know, cat jumps on a hot stove, gets burned. He's not going to jump on a hot stove again, but he's not going to jump on a cold stove over. And to have an investing generation kind of give up on capital formation is really bad for society.
Yeah, well, it's worse than that. A few things. You mentioned about the newbies being momentum players. Well, one thing to keep in mind as a caution to any short seller out there, and I know you talked to some of them, there is a lot of cash on the sidelines right now. And we monitor that, but that means you can have a rally even at horrible levels, right? One of the biggest consensus things for next year is that it's going to be bad next year. I mean, that's we think so, others think so, and a lot of the times the consensus is wrong. Now, I happen to think next year is going to be bad, but don't mistake that with prudent risk management, right? It can be that we have a violent rally, a melt-up scenario in that sort of environment. It could be that some crisis whacks us, Fed comes out with a fire hose and asset prices start spiking up. So keep that in mind as a potential risk scenario. The other one, though, about talking about people disillusioned, people aren't just disillusioned with the markets. They are disillusioned with capitalism because they've been told what's been happening is capitalism, and it is not. We have done a horrible job at defending capitalism. So, and that expresses themselves in policies, right? And people that get elected that set policy. And that creates an environment that is not very constructive for equities in the long run, right? And so that's why I'm saying it's worse. Because if it were only that people get disillusioned and then they go back into the market at the next peak, well, so be it. Tough luck. But I think we're creating much more damage along the way for the foundations of capitalism. And if anything, if I can encourage you, since you have access to fantastic people, right, do talk about defenders of capitalism. And I think you do that as well, to get a broad audience to understand what is capitalism and what it is not. And I mean, just take an example, right? The financial crisis, the report that was generated afterwards was a completely partisan hack. It was in 2004, and that's not posted in most places, that some bureaucrats coerced Fannie and Freddie to expand loans to people right. That couldn't afford them. And then the GSEs decided not to publish financials. And so we love to blame the Fed that they were asleep at the wheel. Well, they didn't have any regulatory authority either. Indeed, to say something positive about one of the Fed folks, Janet Yellen was the one who actually was concerned. And she started out barking up some trees and she was told to shut up because FINRA is in charge of those areas, even though it was within banks that they're supposedly supervising. So there was a mess at that stage already. But it's not capitalism, right? Subsidizing housing, or now, I'm pretty sure you've covered it, right? A jumbo loan doesn't start until way over $1 million right now. So we need government subsidy for $1 million homes right now to supposedly have a mortgage market that's functioning. Rather than shutting down Fannie and Freddie, we'll keep blowing them up. That has nothing to do with capitalism, right? And that things go wrong when you give bureaucrats that much power, well, I got news to you. It's not a surprise, unfortunately.
It's not. And my fear here from the capitalism standpoint is, you know, as the reckoning arrives, The populace will gravitate more to the people that are promising them something in the next election, right? And they may even think, hey, all right, people are telling me that socialism's bad, but I kind of feel like I'm getting screwed no matter what happens here. And so I may as well vote for the guys promising to give me something. So I can see politically the country shifting, if we have the type of reckoning that we potentially could hear, to more of those voices, which of course, you know, is probably adding, you know, a lot more of the problem into the mix versus.
And you phrase it exactly right, because you didn't use the words left and right. Those voices don't care whether the populism comes from the left and the right. They can vote for a populist left guy one day and the populist right gal or guy the next day, as long as their needs are felt. And I already, it was in late 2004, I started speaking publicly about how society is shifting and adapting, and we're moving more towards a Latin American type of society. There's one thing, by the way, I disagree with many of the folks who talk about one day we'll have this wonderful reset and we go back to basics. No, we always go further down the rabbit hole, and there's always life afterwards, and we'll start embracing it as a new normal, right? It used to be you had one breadwinner in the house. Now you have two, right? And dare you say that the wife should stay at home, you get slapped in the face. Well, similarly, it used to be at 65, you retire. Well, now at 65, you're proud that you're still part of the working world. And in a few years, you'll get slapped in the face probably for suggesting somebody should retire just because they turned 65. And so society is embracing change. That's just on a high level, but similarly on the political side, right?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to interject one headline into this, which is society does evolve. In many cases, it evolves because it doesn't really have a choice, right? It's just reacting to new situations on the ground. A lot of the spouses having to go to work was because increasingly it takes two incomes to make it. And increasingly, of course, you got two incomes and you're still, you know, having to work extra jobs just to not fall beneath the poverty line there. There's a headline that came out yesterday in CNBC that from a survey of millionaires, 35% of them said it will, quote, take a miracle for them to be able to afford retirement.
That's it. Although just on a different note, I listened to a presentation the other day that talked about retirees. It turns out a lot in our system is built on subsidizing retirees. And today's generation of retirees actually has the highest standard of living that they've ever had, and indeed a higher standard of living or the same standard of living as they had during their working years. And part of it is the elderly are politically strong constituency. And so they've been getting, and who says it's the elderly we should support, right? Should it be the elderly? Should it be the sick? Should it be veterans? Should it be, and these are tough questions, or none of them, right? These are tough questions, but ultimately the ones who get the benefits are the ones who have the biggest lobby. And as society is aging, retirees will lobby for more for themselves. We rarely ever get rid of entitlements. Sometimes we dampen the growth a little bit. And so that creates an interesting dynamic, of course, where the suckers, so to speak, are the ones who are working. And that creates some challenges for themselves. So in the meantime, of course, yes, those who are approaching retirement are worried that they don't have enough money. But fear not, they'll vote for politicians that will take it from the productive folks and give it to them.
Well, they very well may. And my point in general was that, you know, when a third of your millionaires don't feel comfortable about retirement, something's going really wrong.
Yeah, well, a million isn't what it used to be.
A million isn't what it used to be. I mean, you and I are same generation growing up. A millionaire, somebody with $1 million was set for life back when you and I were little kids. Now, clearly, at least based on this headline, they're pretty worried. All right. So real quick, you when you made your comment about being concerned that the U.S. is sort of perhaps on a trajectory that's more Latin American, I presume one of the reasons you feel that way or one of the concerns you have around that is in Latin America, the wealth distribution is very asymmetric, right? You've got a small number of people that own pretty much all the assets. And then you've got, you know, everybody else who's just trying to figure out sort of how to hang on. Is that a fair observation and part of your commentary there?
Yes. And let me just expand on that for a moment. In the US, we have a little less of that concern than much of the other rest of the world. But one reason why we have prosperity is because we have abundant access to energy. And the Industrial Revolution, for example, happened just as we also harvested energy on a bigger scale. It was coal in those days, right? And if you look at the deindustrialization that's happening in Europe with their amazing, amazing policies that they have, you cannot have broad wealth when you don't have access to energy. Because
by amazing, do you mean kind of like crazy policies?
Yeah, I'm being kind. I mean, I did a survey on Twitter whether Germany's energy policy is treasonous. And I used that just one of several points to intentionally emphasize it. And it was still got the plurality of answers there. And so I'll just leave it at that. The point that I'm trying to make is that when you don't have enough energy, then you'll have oppressors and oppressed, because it's the elite, the ruling class, that will dictate who has that access to energy. So forget about stable democracies when you don't have access to energy. And so energy policy is not just climate policy, it is a policy on security and ultimately on democracy as well. Yeah. And unless that is embraced at the top level, we got to watch out, right? I mean, in the US, we're complaining that Biden isn't doing enough and so forth, but we're still lucky compared to what's happening in Europe.
Very good point. You're reminding me I need to get Doomberg back on this channel. As Doomberg says, energy is life. As I like to say, energy is destiny. Great point, Axel. You keep bringing up these great points where I feel like we could just do an entire discussion around that. And we're getting tight on time. I've already blown through the time I told you it would take to do this. If I can, though, I do want to get back a couple of quick questions about the Fed that I just got to get answers to before we let you go here. So one is, there's questions out there about, hey, can the Fed keep hiking as high as Powell wants to, or will it break something first? You even referred to that briefly earlier on. What do you think is more likely? That Powell is able to engineer his maximum rate and then pause and hold it high for long? Or do you feel that before all that happens, something breaks and potentially forces the Fed's hand to change policy?
So a few weeks or months ago, I would have said something is going to break first. And because we saw the canaries in the coal mine, we saw the gilts blow up, right, in the UK. We saw swap lines being extended to Switzerland. That's when the Federal Reserve gives loans to other central banks because there's a dollar shortage. But we haven't seen many follow-ups, right? These things have been contained. We've had the blow-up in crypto. But just as the dot-com bust in 2000 didn't cause collateral damage, we haven't seen a damage on the financial system because of the crypto things. Now, obviously, billions are lost, but what the Fed cares about more than unemployment and inflation is financial stability, right? Right. It's a club to keep the banking system alive. And so now that said, we don't know whether something is going to blow up and the quote-unquote wheels are falling off. That could happen today. It could not happen at all. The odds of that happening, I think, have decreased a little bit. Part of the reason I say that is even though I believe the economy is slowing down, if you look at the so-called financial conditions, they are tighter, but based on the metrics that we look at, they are not super tight. And so the folks that swim naked out there, they may go out of business, but at this stage, and I am very happy, not happy, I might change my mind on that on short notice, but that unknown, I currently don't see it. And so right now, as I indicated, we'll go hike rates through May and then we'll pause. And by the way, just for those who watch these markets more closely, the market is pricing in that rates will be coming down. Anybody in the market that actually puts money down has to make a probabilistic assessment. And so that's why as you go further out, these rate expectations come down. Yeah, what's been surprising and shocking in some ways is how much the 10-year yields had come down over recent days, as we are talking anyway. And with that, real yield expectations are also coming down. And I think that is the market increasingly pricing in the risk of a more significant recession. And that's part of the reason why gold suddenly had the jump higher and so forth. And it all happened a little quickly. So we'll have some volatility in that space. But right now, they will go through May, come hell, and then they'll try to hold on. The only thing I know is unless the wheels are falling off, the Fed will be very, very slow to take things down. That's one of the reasons why I think we'll have a more severe recession and a longer recession. And part of that is they don't have a framework, right? As we talked about earlier, they don't have the framework, so they don't know what else to do. Right? If they lower rates, Powell doesn't want to be an Alpha Burns. And so it has to be the wheels falling off to get him to move. And if that doesn't happen, which I believe is now the more likely scenario, I'm not saying there's a certainty, that means we'll have a grinding slide into a deep recession.
Okay, which is funny to me because it's either we have a grinding slide into a deep recession or something does break and it forces Powell's hand, which again, that's not a bullish development. And yet the market sort of still has this hopium it's holding onto here, but neither of those pathways you just described is positive.
What I don't understand is why before we went on this call, you said we have a fun conversation, right? Tell me where the fun part, comes in. Yeah.
All right. Well, look, in wrapping up here, I had a conversation with Mike Green last week, and he echoed something that I'd heard Danielle DiMartino Booth saying a couple months back, which was suggesting that there is dissension inside the Fed that we don't see, but it is going on, and that there's jockeying for position to be Powell's successor. And so I've heard the term used at times that it's sort of like Game of Thrones there, where I believe that Powell has his word is final. But it doesn't mean that all of his lieutenants see exactly the world the same way that he does. And some people think that Lael Brainard, who has been traditionally more dovish, is maybe jockeying to supplant him. But Bullard might have some eyes on the chair too. I guess my question for you is the Fed more harmonious than that? Or indeed is Jerome Powell kind of forcing his will on a somewhat unwilling cadre of lieutenants?
Let me give you a few answers here. First of all, Powell's term is not up for another 3 years, which means if he sticks around, it's the next president, or at least the next administration, that's going to decide on the successor. So something to keep in mind. He is a lawyer by training, he's a consensus builder. I don't think he actually has too strong views on many of these topics. If you look at the market reactions, Jim Bullard is one of the most influential ones right now. All the more shocking that when Bullard said the other day, hey, I think the Fed may need to go to 7%, the market didn't blink and said, I'm not going to take this guy seriously. But you do have the more dovish tones increasingly speak up. And so that's part of this process of peak hawkishness that we probably have seen and peak hawkishness is defined as we're moving from 75 basis points to 25 basis points. And so those voices are gradually increasing. But ultimately, yeah, it's the chair that calls the shots. But it doesn't really matter when there is no framework, right? The framework is only higher for longer. That is not a strategy.
Okay. And because it's not a strategy, don't let me put words in your mouth. What odds do you give the Fed of being able to engineer its goal of CPI getting back down into the 2-3, the sub 3% range, I'll say, by the end of next year?
It's the wrong question because your question implies linearity. This is not linear, right? We will get some inflation print that's going to go down. And by the way, when Volcker beat inflation, it took years before it was at 2%. Everybody had a sigh of relief when it was between 3-4%, right? So let's keep that in mind as well. And again, we don't know what this higher for longer means. Are they going to declare victory when inflation is at 3.5%? And then what, right? And it's, again, these are all reasons why a framework is so much more important than just this higher fund longer nonsense that doesn't really do much other than induce a recession. And so we know if history is, in the late 40s, it was different. Inflation literally did just fizzle out. But that is the exception rather than the rule. And so normally inflation does come down, and then it may be down for a few months, and then it's going to start flaring back up. And then what, right?
Right. And so that's why I asked the question, which is, and you're giving the answer I was hoping you would give, which is, it's not as simple as a lot of people are thinking it may be, and to a certain extent, maybe that we're being sold, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So last question before I ask where folks can follow you and your work. You made the comment that you see that we're not in a recession yet, but you think odds are good that we will likely be entering one next year. You also said that the bear market is not over yet. So just as you sort of look out towards next year, I think you've also said you think prices will be lower next year than they are. In general, do you think investors should gird for a similar year as we had here in 2022, or more mild or more severe?
First of all, I don't think we're in a recession based on how the government defines it. So just let's make that, yep. that clear. The one of the unique things about this year was that both stocks and bonds plunged dramatically. And part of it is we published a year and a half ago, we talked about that these risk parity strategies that invest in equal buckets of risk in stocks and bonds break down when inflation is high. And that has happened. And so in recent weeks, we have seen correlation work better again. In some ways, markets are quote unquote more normal, because you start to see any of these correlations, they phase in and out, they're not stable. But next year might be the year where diversification might actually work, unlike this year. And I know with many of your guests, you talk about gold mining, a few other things, right? I mean, we manage about $1 billion in gold and gold mining, but and I believe it's going to do well. But next year may be a good reason to actually have a more diversified approach. And I know some of your listeners love to be in all cash. That has some advantages and disadvantages, right? I'm certainly not blaming them for choosing cash over equities in the current environment. But I think what will be different next year is that correlations will have at the very least morphed. And so I don't think we'll be in a year where stocks and bonds will be down the same amount. I could well imagine an environment where bonds will do quite well and stocks will do horribly. And part of it is because there will be a rally in bonds as the economy is slowing down. There will be volatility. Translated to my space, I do believe that if we do have a deep recession, the sort of assets that tend to do well, if it's a deeper recession, is gold that senses the Fed pivot earlier than others. And when financing conditions, when there's more clarity on that, then the gold miners tend to react much, much earlier. I'm not suggesting everybody should pile the money into those things because they are highly volatile assets. But if you can stomach the risk, then I think we'll see much more favorable markets for these. If we only have a shallow recession, if the Fed can pull off the soft landing, which is a very, very low probability in my book, it can be that standard equities are going to do well because they'll anticipate that and they'll go off and soar. That's not my baseline scenario. Indeed, I don't even think that's a likely scenario. I think it's more likely that if I'm wrong and the wheels do fall off, which a few weeks ago I would have thought is a likely scenario, then the Fed will come in and we'll get a huge squeeze and the dollar will surge for just briefly. The Fed will open the floodgates, and then we'll finally enter the secular dollar bear market. It could be that we've already initiated a dollar bear market as of the quote-unquote Fed pivot from 75 to 50 basis points. A lot of that depends on the details. And of course, my crystal ball is as good as anyone's, right? by the way, the one thing to do with crystal balls like mine or anybody's is to just put them into your own analysis as to have you considered those scenarios. I don't have a claim of being right. I've been wrong more than once over my decade. That's the privilege of having been in the markets for a few years.
All right. Well, really well said. I had so many other questions I'd love to dig into with you, especially given your background in currencies. The dollar is a whole topic we didn't even get into yet, Axel. We'll just have to have you back on again in the future. I'm glad you emphasize diversification. That is something that we have been emphasizing a lot during this year. We've actually, to your point about bonds, we've had a lot of really specific conversations about bonds on this channel recently for the reasons that you just mentioned. All right. Well, look, Axel, thank you for giving us so much of your time. For folks that have really enjoyed getting to know you through this conversation, would like to follow you and your work, where can they go?
You can come to AmericanInvestments.com and browse around from there. You get some links to some products that we manage in gold and gold mining and stagflation. I'm active on Twitter at AxelMerck is probably the one where you get the unfiltered news on a moment by moment basis. You might have seen me there because Adam, you sometimes comment on my tweets, so it shows up to your followers. But do follow me, and then I think your YouTube channel is the place to see me if you have me back. And when you have me back,
oh, it'll be definitely be a win.
Exactly. No, but come. Yeah, we have a free newsletter at Merck Investments. Sign up for that. Follow me on Twitter and browse around a little bit of what we do.
Fantastic. And then Axel, anything, any updates? Last time we talked, you were in it just launched your stagflation ETF. Anything you want to let the audience know about that, especially given the era we're going into, and maybe share the ticker with them if they want to check it out?
Yes, STGF is the ticker. And a few things on that, just briefly. The reason we launched that is because we don't think stagflation is a theme just for a month or so. It's the reaction of policymakers that really extends the agony on these things. Now, since the launch, if you look at the performance, it hasn't been fantastic. And part of the reason is that we have a very large allocation to TIPS, to inflation-protected securities. And part of that reason is, by the way, the risk, and we invest in TIPS, in gold, in oil, in real estate. And the idea was really to have a bond alternative to be able to diversify rather than putting all your money into gold or one of those things, to have something that has a lower risk profile. And TIPS, when you buy TIPS, you're locking in the real rate over a period. And so because the Fed had been hawkish, those real rates had been moving higher, and that's, you have lost some money in TIPS, right? And so if you think we've reached peak hawkishness, then that is the time to get into TIPS or something like our stagflation ETF. And I'm not making an investment recommendation here because I'm not allowed to, but please do have a look at that and then feel free to reach out to us for more information.
Great. And folks, if for those of you who may not be familiar with what TIPS are, I did a video a couple months back just explaining what they are. If you want to watch the explainer video after this one, I'll put up a link to it right here.
And we actually wrote an analysis of what TIPS are. So one reason to come to Merck Investments, we've been told it's a really nice explainer as well. We'll compete with your video explainer, so we'll see what they learn.
Folks, go watch whichever one. Axel's a smarter guy than I, so go to MerckInvestments.com. All right, folks, well, look, as we wrap up here, I think Axel did a phenomenal job in general, but certainly underscoring the main message that we convey on this channel, where it's a very treacherous time. There's a lot of uncertainty out there for the average investor. These are very rocky rapids to try to navigate on your own. So we highly recommend that you try to navigate them with the partnership and collaboration with a professional financial advisor that understands the big issues that we're talking about here. You know, Axel and I were just talking about that. We've kind of created this whole profession of momentum chasers here. You don't want to work with one of those guys. You want to work with some guy or some individuals who understand the trends that we're talking about here, you know, understand the arc of history, understand the probabilities that Axel has been laying out here. If you've got a good one, great, stick with them. They are literally worth their weight in gold. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, consider talking with the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. It's a free consultation. There's no commitment to work with them. It's just a public service that they offer. To do that, just go fill out the short form at wealthion.com. And if you've really enjoyed having Axel on the program, would like to have him come back on again and have us also get other great guests of his caliber, please help support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Axel, my friend, thanks so much for giving us so much of your time today.
Be well and happy holidays.
All right. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.